right. Now, we don't usually do this because normally on Friday you're listening to a pre-recorded segment of Issues Etc. We've got a special live Friday edition of Issues Etc. for you today. We took Monday off, and so we just pushed the whole Issues Etc. week ahead one day, rounding off your work week with some live Issues Etc. Here in the first 25 minutes, we're going to be having a bit of open lines. We'll take your questions and your comments, but a question I have for you. We're going to be hearing from Nina Shea, who is Vice Chair of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, and we're also going to be hearing from Terry Law on the Iraqi Constitution. A couple weeks ago, there were a few concerns raised about religious freedom and other types of human rights in the new Iraq. Well, now everyone's concerned about what this new constitution might bring. The question I have for you, if, in fact, human rights would not prevail in the new Iraq, if, in fact, the Islamic religion becomes either the or a basis for legislation and how those laws would later be judged in the new Iraq, will the war in Iraq have been worth it to you? That's my question for you. I want your answer here in the first 25 minutes. 505-7850-1-800-730-2727. It's open lines coming to you live Friday, August the 26th, here on Issues Etc. Then, for the remainder of the first hour, after open lines, your questions and your comments, Pastor Daniel Conrad joins us. We're going to talk about missions, mission work, and missiology. He spent more than 20 years as a missionary in, well, lo and behold, in Venezuela. We'll have to ask him about Pat Robertson's recent comments. We had a caller yesterday saying, had he been in the mission field when Pat Robertson made that kind of comment about assassinating Hugo Chavez, he might have feared for his own life as a missionary. We'll find out what Pastor Conrad has to say about that at the beginning of our conversation with him. In the second hour of the program, we're going to hear a short segment. It's about a 10-minute interview between Bill O'Reilly and a medical professional who has caught a lot of heat for attempting to publish and attempting to promote intelligent design. We'll hear what transpired on the O'Reilly Factor with some audio there at the beginning of the second hour, and then Dr. David Menton joins us to react to something that was in the paper in Saturday's St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Debate continues over teaching alternatives to evolution. We'll talk about intelligent design and creationism and evolution with Dr. David Menton of Washington University in the second hour of the program. Now, in the third hour, we're going to be hearing a sermon, another sermon review. We did one earlier this week. We'll do one a little bit later today. A regular guest here on the program, Dr. Jeff Gibbs, a sermon given recently in the chapel of Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. His text, Psalm 25, verses 1 through 7. Open your Bibles there in the third hour. We're going to be reviewing a sermon from Dr. Jeff Gibbs, and we'll just use our regular three-part diagnostic as we usually do. We'll round off today's Issues Etc. live this Friday, the 26th of August, a special live edition of Issues Etc. with Scott Klusendorf, president of Life Training Institute. We want his reaction to this story in JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, on fetal pain. We have some audio from the editor of JAMA, her justification for publishing the article, and the kind of reaction she's been getting. Scott Klusendorf will respond to some of the comments she makes there in the last 25 minutes or so of Issues Etc. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. My question for you is this, and I want your answer to it here in the first 25 minutes of Issues Etc. If it turns out, as many are concerned it will, that in the new Iraq there will be fewer human rights, and especially no religious freedom to speak of, not real religious freedom, then will the war in Iraq have been worth it to you? Your answer to that question, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Well, we've been saving this for a couple of days because time has been running out each and every day, but Nina Shea, who is vice chair of the U.S. Commission on the International Religious Freedom, says that the draft constitution for the new Iraq may be contradictory when it comes to the role of religion in Iraqi society.
I think that what they're going to try to do is have a carve-out of religious freedom, but it's going to be a dog's breakfast. We're going to see religious freedom, and we're going to see provisions for Islamic law. And basically, they're not reconcilable.
So she is predicting at this point, from what she can read from the draft constitution, that these two concepts, yes, we affirm religious freedom, but of course, we're going to have a preference for Islamic law. And as the draft reads, Islamic law is considered a basis for legislation. And we do not know what will happen. What will their Supreme Court look like if they have one? Will it, because, of course, if Islamic law has to have some bearing upon their legislation, will it have to have, well, experts in Islamic law, religious clerics on the Supreme Court, in order to interpret the law in light of Islam? You can see how these two things would be on a collision course for one another. And everywhere else where Islam becomes the basis for legislation, every other Islamic country, religious freedom not only suffers, it ceases in any real sense to exist. Now, Shea says that Iraq's constitution shouldn't be like the one that was adopted in Afghanistan.
There can be no law that contradicts Islam in Afghanistan. Therefore, journalists who have criticized the political system have been charged by the state with blasphemy.
Now, granted, our goal in Afghanistan was not so much to unseat a ruler and institute a democratic government with all the freedoms that come along with the democratic government. Our goal was to take out the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, and they were intertwined with one another there in Afghanistan. So Afghanistan constitutionally didn't turn out so well. Of course, we never set the goal of having it turn out that well. Iraq is different. Iraq has been, by everyone's admission, nation building. At least the latter part of the effort has been, of necessity, nation building. That means a constitution. That means, does its constitution grant religious freedom and other human rights? If it doesn't, will the war in Iraq have been worth it to you? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Finally, here again from Nina Shea of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. She says that a constitution that places Iraq under Islamic law would hurt women as well.
Islamic law would end up trumping women's rights, women's inheritance rights, child custody. Women may not even have equal rights in terms of their weight of their testimony in court.
So what do you do? Along with, see, these freedoms are of a piece. I know that in our Constitution, we have these freedoms acknowledged in 10 individual amendments. But the philosophy that has pervaded American thinking is these freedoms are all of one piece. We may enumerate them differently, but we're really talking about, as our founding documents might say, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And when we expand on those, we have things like freedom of speech and freedom of the press and freedom of religion. Freedom of religion comes, it gets pride of place in our Constitution. But if in the Iraqi Constitution, Islam becomes the basis for law, well, everywhere else that's been tried, religious freedom hasn't survived the process. If it doesn't in Iraq, will your views on the war, the value of this war, change? We had a caller yesterday, a couple days ago. She said, look, the war is a good effort because in the end, we'll bring freedom, and freedom will give us the freedom in Iraq to preach the gospel. But freedom has to come first. But what if there isn't freedom? In other Islamic nations, where there isn't freedom, religious freedom in particular, you might well be able to be a Christian. But, say, Saudi Arabia, you can't own a Bible. You cannot assemble freely with other Christians. That is, in other words, go to church. You certainly cannot proselytize. Even in Turkey, where there's more religious freedom than any other Islamic nation on earth, there's a limited type of religious freedom. One of the issues, and this is raised by some audio we have for you here in just a second, has to do with whether or not someone could even change religions. In many Islamic nations, for a Muslim to convert to anything else means a death sentence. Now, if that's the case in Iraq, when all is said and done, when the Constitution is signed and the ink is dry, will this war have been worth it to you? I want your answer to that question. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. It's Open Lines, Issues, etc. We are coming to you live this Friday. It's August the 26th. It's a special live Friday edition of Issues, etc. All 3 hours. Now, another person concerned about the new Iraqi constitution is the Reverend Terry Law. He is president of World Compassion. And he is particularly concerned about the religious freedom issue. He says that Iraqi officials are willing to guarantee some religious rights, but not the freedom to convert from Islam to another religion.
Islamic law would end up trumping
Iraqi
women's rights, women's inheritance rights.
Let's try that one again. We just got to just solo out that. We'll get it back here. Back to that audio. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Just solo out that first law cut, if you would. All right, let's try this again. Here's his concern about, well, while it would grant some religious freedom, the freedom to convert from Islam is not granted.
If you deal with the Iraqi authorities on this change your religion issue, that's where you run into the brick wall. And I ran into that wall last week with the Prime Minister, Ibrahim al-Jafri.
Now, he's going to describe that in just a moment, what that encounter was like. Now, this is key. It's one thing for a country to say, look, everybody has the freedom of religion, if you are something, but nobody can change. Or, as in most Islamic nations, if you're a Muslim, you stay a Muslim. Now, if you're a Christian, or a Buddhist, or a Jew, you're free to become a Muslim. But if you're a Muslim, you stay a Muslim. That's the way the law works, because that's what Islam would provide as a basis of legislation by way of religious freedom. Now, notice here we're not talking about tolerance so much as freedom. We're talking about the specific freedoms granted or acknowledged by a constitution. Terry Law also says that he told Iraq's prime minister that religious liberty included the right to convert.
I looked him in the eye and I said, sir, if someone were to move from Islam to another religion and he were killed for doing that, is that not the most basic abuse of human rights? Isn't the right to life and to live basic? He avoided the issue, would not answer the question.
So how important is it to you and your view of what should prevail in Iraq when the war is over with? Let's put it this way. 5 years from now, everything's said and done, the constitution's in place, Iraq has been rebuilt, and you have the opportunity to visit the new Iraq. And when you get there, you visit some Christian friends. They say, what's it like living in this country now? And they say, well, not so good. Well, why is that? Well, we kind of have to keep our religion to ourselves. We are not especially favored in society. There are a lot of strictures put on us because we're not Muslims. Can't own a Bible. We cannot talk freely about our faith in public. And we can't assemble for church. We got to do it all here very privately in our home. And even then, we're a little scared. Well, can you witness to anybody? No, that's illegal. Well, have you seen anyone become a Christian? Nobody wants to become a Christian. It's illegal to become a Christian in this country, in Iraq. You have that conversation 5 years from now. You look back on the war in Iraq as it is now. Would it have been worth it to you? Now, the Reverend Law says that his supporters are calling for full religious liberty in the Iraqi constitution.
We are promoting the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which declares that everyone should have freedom to change his religion or belief.
And then finally, the Reverend Terry Law, president of World Compassion, says that people should petition the Iraqi government for full religious liberty.
I would like to have 1 million petitions. Fly into Baghdad with those petitions. Go on national television and speak to the moderate middle in the country and tell them, let your voice be heard. Tell the leaders of your government that you are demanding total religious freedom in your constitution.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. So those are the concerns expressed by Nina Shea of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. Those are the concerns expressed by Terry Law. And those are concerns that are shared by many nowadays. Do you share them? And do they affect your view on the war? It's a special live Friday edition of Issues Etc. Open lines 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Let's talk first with Greg, who calls from his car. Greg, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call, and thanks for doing this topic. I got to be honest, this has never even crossed my mind. But my opinion, my 2 cents for what it's worth is, as long as it is truly free and that the men are allowed to vote, change will come. I think that America has come an awful long way since the birth of our nation as far as what we're allowed to do as far as our freedoms, especially if you're a black man or a woman. those things weren't, they didn't have those things afforded. But what was true was there was freedom to vote. And eventually, maybe not 5 years, but eventually, Iraq will get it right as far as religious freedom.
All right, Greg, I admire your optimism. I admire your optimism. But I would point out just two things. You might be right, in time. But in the meantime, the lack of religious freedom is intolerable. And I would also point out that the United States began with an explicit grant of religious freedom or acknowledgement of religious freedom with the first of the first 10 amendments. Those came very quickly, and they were there almost at the birth of our Constitution. And even though they weren't there explicit at the very signing of our Constitution, when I think one might argue that when the first 10 amendments were written, they were simply explaining in detail what they meant implicitly when they signed the thing. But we've had religious freedom for 200 plus years. Your argument is, well, they'll get religious freedom eventually if democracy prevails. What about the rest of you? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Josh calls from his car. Hi, Josh. Josh, welcome.
Hi. You asked the question, will the war be worth it to me? And regardless of what the purpose of the war might have been, to me it would be, the war will be worth it to me as long as the new regime in Iraq is one that is friendly to us and does not harbor terrorists. If there is religious freedom, I very much want there to be religious freedom, but that's not why we're there, and we can't do everything, basically.
All right, Josh, thank you. But when the president says freedom, bringing freedom to Iraq, he certainly means freedom. Kind of the whole undivided kind of freedom that we enjoy. You say freedom to Americans, they hear freedom. I don't see any asterisks next to the president's declarations that he wants to see a free Iraq. Do you? I don't. I would love to ask President Bush, if there isn't religious freedom, will your goal have been reached? I don't know what he'd answer, but I think he'd answer no. But you can't always get everything you want. Alice calls from St. Louis. Alice, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Oh, hello. I don't think that it would be worth it because we will have had Christians then that have died and put their lives on the line for an idolatrous religion, for a religion that is not according to our beliefs. And even under Saddam Hussein, as horrible as he was, there are Christian Iraqis who are going to be persecuted and killed because they are Christians. So, no, this is going backwards. And we cannot say that we want right on one end and not have it on the other end of the stick.
Alice, thanks. We had a caller yesterday who said, look, we're not fighting to establish an Islamic state over there. We may be fighting to establish a state where Muslims have freedom, along with all others having freedom. But we're not fighting to establish an Islamic state. You hear this debate over the federalism issue that they're talking about so much in the news? You know what they're really talking about? Are we going to have an Islamic state or not? Because the people who are fighting for federalism are not Muslims. Many of them are Christians. And they know that a federal form of government means that it won't be an Islamic state. Or that they could carve out a little piece, a state for themselves where Sharia law is not the law. This seems a pretty precipitous moment. I think, really, although a lot of people are just rolling their eyes and yawning when they hear about a draft constitution. Of course, we've been hearing about constitutions for months now. And will the constitution pass and will it grant religious freedom? People say, come on, let's not sweat the details. Let's just get a constitution. We need to bear in mind that there are good constitutions and there are bad constitutions. I mean, even communist nations had something resembling constitutions. They were terrible documents. You wouldn't want to live under them. So just because we get a constitution, does it mean we declare victory? Does victory mean Iraq being an Islamic state, just like most other Islamic states? 505-7850-1-800-730-2727. Am I putting too high a priority on religious freedom here? I mean, come on, be realistic, Wilkin. What we wanted to do is get Saddam Hussein out of power. Done. What we want to do is stop the rape rooms and the systematic oppression of a people for a quarter of a century. Done. What we wanted to do was grant a greater measure of freedom to these people, and at the very least, the vote. Almost done. We wanted to eliminate a threat to the United States. As far as we can tell, done. Religious freedom wasn't on the list, but maybe we'll put it on the list next time. 505-7850-1-800-730-2727. You know, we take for granted so much religious freedom in our nation. It is granted in our Constitution. And yet there's another side to that sword. There's a sharp edge to the other side of that sword. And that is American civil religion. Along with the religious freedom we all enjoy, there is, of course, the freedom to profoundly confuse religions, which is what happens in American civil religion today. You can read about it in our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for August, The Anonymous God. For more information, go to our website, issuesetc.org. You'll find the book right there on our homepage, The Anonymous God, or call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours, their toll-free number, and you've got 90 minutes to call. 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Mention Issues Etc. when you talk with the customer service rep and ask for the book of the month for August. Antoine calls from his car. Hi, Antoine.
Hey, how's it going, man?
Very well.
All right. You know, the lady just got off. You know, she made a valid point. You know, with us being a Christian nation, America, you know, based on being a Christian nation, and our soldiers and so on, but we over there helping the Muslim fight for, you know what I'm saying, for their religion and so on. My question is, what do you think, once we help Iraq, right, do you think the Iraq is going to want to leave Israel alone, or are they still going to want to destroy Israel? You follow what I'm saying?
I follow what you're saying, Antoine. I thank you for the question. I think it's a valid question. Whether it comes from a religious perspective, that is, make no mistake about it, Antoine, I do not buy into the notion that America is a Christian nation, and I do not buy into the notion that Israel is somehow has most favored nation status with God, nor the U.S. But as a political question, hey, there's another one we might want to consider. We have an ally there in the region, and if it's an Islamic nation, and by the way, a democracy. So if they do vote a bad man into office, they voted a bad man into office. And if that bad man wants to press a clause in the Constitution that says, hey, it says here in the Constitution that Islam is the basis for our legislation, and he institutes full-blown Sharia law like in some other nations, what are we going to do about it? When we come back, more open lines for your questions and your comments here on this special live edition Friday on Issues Etc.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
If the Bible is abundantly clear that homosexual behavior is an abomination before God, then how is it that long-time mainline denominations can be embracing it? We talked about that earlier today on our Ask the Pastor Bible Study with Pastor Joe Cox. If you missed it, tune in tonight for the Bible Study repeat at 7:05.
The Bible Study on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Concordia Christian Books and Gifts, serving God's people.
How would you like to meet Issues Etc. regular guests Wesley Smith, Beverly Yonke, Gene Edward Veith, James Lamb, Bob Weiss, David Menton, and Nathan Jastrom all in one day? Well, they'll be speaking at the Image of God Bioethics Conference Friday, November the 11th at the Sheraton Westport Lakeside Chalet in St. Louis. For more information, go to our website, issuesetc.org, and join us as we broadcast live from the Image of God Bioethics Conference November the 11th in St. Louis.
Have you thought about starting a prayer network This Global Minute lets you hear about the Hakka Prayer Net. A number of missionaries and Christians in Taiwan have started a prayer network for the Hakka, an unreached people group, and progress is being made. After years of explaining the gospel to key Hakka men, new churches have started, and new missionaries are finding ways to share with more Hakka men and women. But they know they need prayer to break through the spiritual barriers, so they've enlisted a variety of people from different countries, sending regular prayer updates by email. You could volunteer to start a prayer network for a particular people group or even a missionary family. Start small, but pass along prayer requests to new Christians you meet and ask them to be prayer partners. Prayer is a calling for all Christians. Get info and updates you need with a touch of inspiration at missionvisionnetwork.org, missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Communications have changed. Well, Dale, everyone knows that. Do we? The evangelistic zeal of many Christians is encouraging, at least to those of us who take seriously Jesus' command to spread the gospel. And many seminary students have that zeal. But when I ask if they know what a blog is, only a few have any idea. Blog is short for weblog, a kind of online diary by which a person, the blogger, can put into cyberspace whatever word he or she wants to get out. Around our house, it's a she, my wife Diane, who's been blogging stories and pictures for over a year. When Diane blogged pictures of our week at Camp Arcadia, a beautiful setting on the shore of Lake Michigan, I thought, family pictures? Who wants to look at family pictures? Wrong. Almost 3,000 people have visited her blog just to see those pictures. Yes, communications really have changed, but church people can be slow to get into the new era. Martin Luther wasn't when he embraced the printing press to get out the message of God's forgiving grace. And back in the 1920s, a man named Walter Meyer wasn't slow to see the possibilities of radio. The message of the Bible does not change, but how about the ways we're getting it out today? Thanks for listening. I'm Dale Meyer.
Dining with sinners. That's what happens every Sunday at Bethany Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights, Illinois. The Lord Jesus himself comes and spreads his banquet table before us, sinners, not a target group of professionals, but sinners in need of the one thing that only he can give, the forgiveness that he won for us at the cross. Christian, seeker, unbeliever, it doesn't matter. All those who are burdened by their sin and hungry for God's forgiveness are invited to visit Bethany Lutheran Church, 5600 Old Collinsville Road in Fairview Heights. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're coming to you live this Friday. It's the 26th of August. Joining us for the next 25 minutes here in the first hour, Pastor Daniel Conrad is our guest. He is pastor of Zion Lutheran Church in Tarabella, California, but he spent more than 20 years as a missionary in Venezuela. He joins us to talk about missions, mission work, and missiology. Pastor Conrad, welcome to Issues Etc.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Our call-in numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Feel free to join us as we talk about missions here in this 25 minutes. Pastor Conrad, I know that you spent that time in Venezuela, and I must ask, recently the Reverend Pat Robertson of the Christian Broadcasting Network made a comment about assassinating Hugo Chavez, who was the president of Venezuela. Had you been in the mission field at the time when he made those comments, how would you have taken those things?
Well, I would have taken it with a lot of concern because, for one thing, I was there during part of his reign as president, and I can't say that I see eye to eye with all of his policies. At the same time, I do believe that, you know, he was elected, and we do have to pay attention to the the election and how the Lord can work through the duly constituted government. Furthermore, I think it would have given me a lot of fear because, see, what can happen in that circumstance is that Chavez could use this to really judge all North Americans, and it could really put them in a lot of danger, and it could conceivably, you know, make him want to say that all North Americans would have to get out of the country, and our work would suffer accordingly. And I think one thing, too, is I realize that not all Christians, he does not speak for all Christians, I realize that, but in some people's eyes, he would be speaking for all North Americans. And so I just have very serious reservations about that statement. I don't feel he should have made it.
How does the Bible define mission work?
Well, actually, the Bible, the word mission doesn't really appear in the Bible per se. You know, mission comes from, missio, the idea of to be sent. It doesn't necessarily define it precisely. However, we get through the Gospel of Matthew, through Mark, through Luke, and even through St. John, we do get the idea that he sends the disciples, he sends our churches out to go ahead and to make disciples by baptizing and by teaching, and also by proclaiming, you know, the remission of sins. And so that's how I define mission work, is making disciples of the Lord through baptizing and teaching.
I'm thinking about a passage that is very seldom cited as the basis for the church's mission. More often than not, it's the so-called Great Commission of Matthew 28, and that gets cited quite a bit. But one comes in the Gospel of John in John's 20th chapter, where Jesus specifically uses that word that you just mentioned, where he says, "Just as the Father sent me, so now I send you." He breathes on them and gives them his Holy Spirit, and he says, "Whoever sins, you forgive, they're forgiven. Whoever sins, you retain, they're retained." Is that a commissioning of his disciples to do the mission of the church?
Well, absolutely, because the Greek word there that you have in that word, as the Father sent me, is apostello, which actually is where the apostle comes from. And so what he was doing was he was giving them full authority to go in his name to go and remit and retain sins. And that is the essence of the gospel. And this goes ahead, and this defines what mission work is really all about, because this is the one thing that Christianity can give the world that nobody else can, no government or no other religion, and that is the remission of sin.
I want to spend some time on something you said there in your first response that I think is often overlooked when it comes to the mission of the church, and that is the role of baptism. It's just like we read over that for some reason in Matthew chapter 28, and we think it's all about going out into the nation, getting missionaries into the field, and then baptism kind of falls by the wayside. But before we get there, describe some ways that this concept of the church's mission is misused by the church.
Well, I think sometimes what we can do, or what has happened, is like, for example, when I was down in Venezuela, I ran into a lot of people from the Lutheran World Federation. And their idea of mission was, well, you know, what we ought to really be doing is, you know, there's a lot of social injustice in Latin America, there's a lot of hunger, and what we really got to work on is let's get these oppressive structures eliminated, let's go ahead and feed the people and get them stable, and then that way they might be able to go ahead and hear the gospel. As a matter of fact, when I told one LWF missionary what our task was, as Lutheran Church Missouri said, missions to go ahead, missionaries to make disciples by baptizing and teaching, he could not believe that. Because his idea was, no, what we have to work on is social justice. Now, certainly, understand me well, I am for, all the disaster relief that we do in the LCMS, and I think that's great. I'm certainly, for trying to help as much as we can with hunger and medicine and everything. But the task, the missionary task of the church is not done until everyone is a disciple through baptizing and teaching. And so if you followed the LWF argument to its logical extreme, if everybody was well fed, well, the mission would be done. And, we do have to have the social needs, but at the same time, the gospel is what's going to confer to them eternal salvation.
It sounds a lot like what someone tried to teach me when I was in college about liberation theology.
Yeah.
Well, we need to get out there and change the social and political structures, and that is really the mission of the church, to improve people's lot, to take those who are disenfranchised and re-enfranchise them, if that's even a word.
Yes, that was very common, particularly in Latin America, particularly when the Marxist governments were strong in the Soviet Union and in Europe. This was the polemic that you heard a lot of times with the liberation theologians that, no, what we really have to work on is getting rid of these oppressive structures that are oppressing the people.
What are some other ways that the mission of the church is misused?
Well, I think that another way that we can go ahead and misuse the church, the mission of the church sometimes too, is when we don't go ahead and define what the church is and what discipling is. You see, a lot of times I think what can happen is that a lot of times we go ahead and we say things, well, okay, we have to, make disciples. We have to go ahead and, get people to confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. And I think, well, to an extent that's true. But see, sometimes what we can do if we're not careful is we can just go ahead and get a generic brand of Christianity. And I think when Dr. Norman Nagel came down to Venezuela, it was, I think, in 1986, 87. I don't have the precise date with me, but when he was in Caracas, he gave a very profound statement and he made a rhetorical question: what can the Lutheran Church give to the world that nobody else can? And that is the pure preaching of the word and the pure administration of the sacraments. And so I think we as the Lutheran Church have to be very, very insistent upon our pure doctrine, upon our pure preaching, and our pure administration of sacraments, because in that way we will offer the world something that no one else can.
So often you hear mission work, whether it is at home or abroad, described in precisely those bare minimum terms. Well, we're just going to get out there and preach the gospel. And it seems to ignore the latter part of Jesus' Great Commission, to teach them everything
exactly.
I have commanded you.
Exactly. And furthermore, when we see the Great Commission, and I've read it a lot in a lot of magazines, particularly evangelical magazines, I see a lot of things about the Great Commission, Matthew 28, and this kind of thing. But see, when you get into the Great Commission and you study it in its original form, what's very interesting is the word "make disciples" is an imperative. There's no doubt about it. Okay, but the word, what he's going ahead, and he's got the participles for baptizing and teaching. And so, okay, we go ahead and we make disciples, but how do we make disciples? We got to go ahead and we make disciples by baptizing and by teaching. And so just to talk about Matthew 28 for 3 or 4 hours without making any mention of, like, baptizing and teaching, I think is doing a terrible injustice to the context of what that verse was.
So grammatically, the point you're making there, I think this is one that's also made even in the title of the book recently by Robert Kolb, Make Disciples by Make Disciples Baptizing, is that the means for making these disciples is very explicit. It is through the sacrament of baptism. It is through the teaching and preaching of God's word of law and gospel.
Exactly. And I think what happens is that, for example, the idea that we teach, like in the Lutheran Church, is that evangelization and making disciples comes through the means of baptism is something that's not very acceptable to evangelicals, because they don't view the baptism as a sacrament. For them, it's a great symbol, but it's not a sacrament. And so that's why our Lutheran theology has quite a contribution to make to the study of missiology, because it's on the basis of sound theology.
Is baptism mission work?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because through baptism, that is how a person is brought from darkness into light. And that is a fundamental part of our missionary mandate.
Is another way that the mission of the church is misused is that we talk about missions, and then we kind of walk away saying, boy, I went to the great conference on missions, and forget that it actually has to be done.
Yes. Well,
talking about it is one thing. Doing it is another.
Well, I think it's kind of a humorous thing, what you're saying, because, I've seen that. I've gone to my share of I've gone to Great Commission conferences and Great Commission convocations, and I guess they're all done with good intentions and everything like that. But you're kind of right. It's almost sometimes it can almost be like a cheerleading type of thing, where as soon as that Great Commission convocation or some conference is done, well, we feel so good about ourselves. But boy, if we could have just spent that money and that energy going out and doing mission, I just wonder if that would be the more productive means, Certainly, I'm not questioning the good intentions of these conferences or the people that put them on, But I think the thing is, I think a lot of the mission work is really doing it more than anything else, more than talking about it.
Pastor Daniel Conrad is our guest. We're talking about missions, mission work, missiology. He's pastor of Zion Lutheran Church in Tarabella, California, and he spent 20 years as a missionary in Venezuela. So to kind of tie up your past and your present, would you say that substantially there's really any difference between what you were doing for 20 years in Venezuela and what you're doing now as a pastor in Tarabella?
Well, I had a different set of responsibilities. Certainly, any part where you work at, you've got to be a pastor because you're going to go ahead and you're going to administer the sacraments and preach the word, which I did here, and I did here in Venezuela. The difference a lot more there is like I was a lot more into theological education, where I was forming and mentoring national pastors through theological education. And so I'm a parish pastor now, so I don't have the opportunity for like the theological education of pastors like I had there. But the means of grace and the preaching and the word of sacrament are the same any place you go.
So let's talk a bit about indigenous pastors or national pastors and the value of having pastors on the ground in the language, in the culture, even as we try our best to keep foreign missionaries in the field as well.
Well, when we are in a situation, for example, overseas, when we go over, at least from the Lutheran perspective, and we're trying to found the church, we do found the church because, see, we don't really have the church founded until you have a community worshiping around word and sacrament. And from that community, you try to identify, and the local congregation tries to identify people who are apt candidates for the pastoral office among them. And this is very important in foreign mission work. It's not that the missionary cannot do a good job. He can. But a lot of times, and in a lot of cases, the national is going to be much more proficient than a missionary. Furthermore, more and more, as we're dealing with terrorism and problems in countries, you know, it doesn't take very much for a government or a dictator or a president just to decree, we don't want any more foreigners in here. And so if we don't go ahead and establish a national pastorate, what would happen is that, you know, as soon as we got pulled out of a country or kicked out of a country, whatever, for whatever reason, then nothing would last. And so that is a very important thing, to try to establish a national pastorate in all the countries that we're working at. Yes.
And someone might say, well, what's the best you can do with young men who are brought up in a congregation? Someone says, well, I think that this young man would make a fine pastor. What kind of a training would he get then in the mission field?
Well, what we were working on was a theological education by extension. When I was working down there, that's what we were working on. We didn't have the money for a resident seminary in all cases, and some of them we sent overseas, like we sent to Brazil. But one of the new things that I was trying to implement, what we were trying to implement down in Venezuela, was I was being very insistent on the teaching of the original languages to the national pastors. Because if we're going to have national pastors, we have to have national theologians that are well-grounded in the scriptures and the original language, and furthermore, in the teachings of our Lutheran confessions. And so we just tried to give the best they could. And then now sometimes I had this one, it's interesting, one time some national pastors were complaining, well, you know, what we're getting is subpar compared to what you guys get in the States. And so the next time I saw them, I handed them a catalog from the Fort Wayne Seminary, and I says, okay, which course here do you guys want? We will get it for you one way or the other. And so this is the most important thing, is to go ahead and you give them the best training possible, because they are responsible for the souls of people, and the better theological education that they have, you know, it's going to be better for the congregation as well.
Well, and after all, I would think that the long-term goal here is, as is happening in so many places, these young men become the trainers of the next generation of pastors. Become, in essence, the seminary and the seminary professors in that country.
Well, absolutely. And I'll never forget one of those years when I was at the confessional symposium there in the Fort Wayne Seminary, and I ran into Dr. Wente, the president, and he was asking me how things were going in Venezuela. At this time, I was teaching Greek down there in Venezuela, and I said to Dr. Wente, I said, well, you know, Dr. Wente, I'm trying to get these guys trained in Greek, and it's my hope that someday they're going to be able to come up here and give a paper at this symposium. And Dr. Wente told me, Dan, I'm looking forward to that day. And so I think that's great because, see, the one thing that I think our national pastors wanted a lot, and I can't blame them for that, but they wanted a good theological education so they would also be capable of giving presentations and writing books and writing articles to share their point of view with the whole world.
You mentioned the confessional nature of this, and you made reference to our Lutheran confessions.
Yes.
Where does that fall as a priority in establishing churches in the mission field that they have a solid confessional basis? And that, I think, would mean having those books, those resources in their language for people.
That's absolutely right. And that's one of the most important things that we can do is translation. We do have the Book of Concord translated into Spanish, and that was a tremendous move. And we were working very diligently on getting more and more of our books and some of our more popular theological treatise in, for example, in the Spanish language. But yes, that's absolutely indispensable, having all that in their language.
Now, you said something there a few minutes ago that caught my ear, and I don't want to gloss over it. You talked about establishing congregations.
Yes.
Churches.
Right.
I think most people think, all right, the church is here, and then we send out a missionary, and he establishes a mission. It's not the church. I mean, he's just out there kind of standing on the corner preaching, or maybe he does gather a congregation someplace. But here's the church. That's the mission.
Well, to an extent, I think every church is a mission, and every mission is a church. The thing that I would say, though, is that, see, the Church of Christ, according to our confessions, is found, you know, wherever we have the administration of the sacraments and wherever we have the preaching of the word. And so I would say that, no, if we have the preaching of the word and the administration of the sacraments, I say that's a manifestation of Christ's church on this earth. Now, it's a local church, but it's certainly a legitimate form of the Una Sancta, which is the invisible church. Now, it doesn't mean that because it's a church that it ceases to be mission. Not at all. However, there has to be a local church, because through that local church, you administer the sacraments and preach the word and nurture the people who are in the Christian faith.
Is that really part of the problem, that we have made this distinction between the church and the mission, and therefore we don't think something like baptism or the administration of the Lord's Supper is as of great importance, and we've misunderstood fundamentally what the church is and what the mission is?
Well, I would say that every church is mission, and every mission is a church. That's what I think. We have to go ahead and realize that wherever there is a local church, wherever we have the preaching of the word and the administration of sacraments, there is the local church. And that can be here in Tarabella, where I'm at. It can be in St. Louis, Missouri. It can be in Siberia. It can be in Barquisimeto, Venezuela, where I served. But it's one faith, one Lord, and one baptism. And so you have the local church there. But, of course, there's a certain amount, there's mission with everything, because we do hope that our local congregation will preach the gospel to the surrounding community and more people will be brought to faith. So I think mission is wherever the church is.
We have a regular guest here on the program who has made the point. He's coined the term missiolatry, a kind of worship of the mission, forgetting that the goal is to draw people to the church, to the life of the church, and not simply to kind of toss the seed out, but to draw them into the life of the church. And I think the Lutheran Layman's League had, and the Lutheran Hour had, this tremendous motto, bringing Christ to the nations and the nations to the church. Do we need to recapture that nature of mission work today?
Well, I think it's very important that we remember one fundamental truth, and that is that we are responsible for preaching the word, but the results are always in the hands of God. And I remember when I had Dr. Marquardt at Fort Wayne Seminary in one of his books, and he said that the church is not established until you have a community around a word and sacrament. And so I think any time we have mission work, my ultimate goal is always, when I have mission work, is I hope that through baptism the person will incorporate themselves, will be incorporated in the church, because the Lord incorporates them through baptism. But furthermore, I hope that they will also be receiving the Lord's Supper. and I don't consider my missionary task done until that. So I would say it goes back and forth because of the fact that we do want the people to be in the church, but then we also have to remember that that only happens through the Holy Spirit working through the means of grace.
How tempting is it in the foreign mission field to engage in what theologians call syncretism, that is, where you mix the Christian faith with other religions, other religious practices, when you're out there in the mission field? How tempting is that? And what do you think of pastors in the United States who participate in syncretistic practices here, like interfaith prayer services?
Well, the thing is, with syncretism, when I was on the field, I don't think we had too much. The problem that we had, for example, in Venezuela, was the idea of, like, for example, a lot of people were what were called animists. And the animists tended to go ahead a lot of times and just mix Christianity with their existing belief. I mean, they just saw Christianity as maybe, you know, a new way to look at God, or this was a new way to help them in given circumstances. And we constantly had to combat against that. Now, as far as, you know, syncretism with unionism, I think we got to be very, very careful with that. I mean, I certainly think that we can dialogue with people of all faiths. You know, I mean, I don't have any problem, you know, like dialoguing, you know, with a Buddhist or a Hindu or a Muslim or anything like that. I would be very, very cautious before going ahead and saying a mutual prayer with him, because it would give him the idea that we're going ahead and we're praying to the same God, and we're not.
And someone would say, look, but for the sake of the mission, why don't you just do it?
Well, I'm not really sure that's going to help God's cause. Now, if our mission is simply to go ahead and teach Jesus as one God among many, well, okay. But if we do believe in Jesus' words that I am the way, the truth, and the life, I think we got to get across the point, I mean, certainly in a diplomatic way and everything, that we believe in a whole true God that is the one true God.
Pastor Daniel Conrad is pastor of Zion Lutheran Church in Tarabella, California. He spent 20 years as a missionary in Venezuela. Pastor Conrad, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for being our guest.
Well, thank you very much.
When we come back from this break, we've got hour two of Issues Etc. ahead for you. You may have seen this or not, but Bill O'Reilly on his O'Reilly Factor interviewed a man who has quite a lot of heat because he's connected himself with the intelligent design movement. Now, we're going to hear this segment from the O'Reilly Factor uninterrupted. It's about 10 minutes or so. And then we're going to join Dr. David Menton from Washington University to discuss intelligent design. And a headline in Saturday's St. Louis Post-Dispatch in the religion section, debate continues over teaching alternatives to evolution. We'll have that, O'Reilly, and then Dr. David Menton when we come back for the second hour of Issues Etc. live this Friday, August the 26th.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at kfuo.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.